Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. She's the infidel your imam warned you about, and there's no holding her back as she shares her opinions, insights, information, and outrage discussing the political entity known as Islam. We are at a critical juncture in our history, and if the threat of Islam is not faced up front, right now, then we will lose the freedoms of individuality, civic justice, and autonomy of thought we rightly enjoy, and instead see our values replaced with kinetic and civilizational jihad, Sharia law, and oppression permanently. Don't let the memory of our soldiers, past and present, go in vain. It is up to us to protect the legacy for which they fought so hard. We have an obligation to honor their memory today and for future generations. Join Kel Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern and Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Blog Talk Radio. But leave your political correctness well away from her phone lines and chat room. And be warned, Kel takes no prisoners.
GoDamnMedia.com.
Changes. We are justified in doing anything we can to survive.
And hello, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger. I am your froggy host, Kel Fritzy. I've been having a touch of laryngitis all week, so please bear with me as I try to get through these shows. But we have a very, very interesting show tonight. As you know, this is the F-Bomb Show, and I'm left to my own devices. As you know, on Mondays at 3 p.m., I co-host with the prolific Tim Burton, as we also co-host together at the Radio Jihad Network. We are the Freedom Loving Infidels, Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. On Fridays, I'm kind of left alone, but I'm not alone tonight. I have a very, very, very dear friend joining me tonight, and that is Michael Green. I don't even call him a guest, because he's just such a dear friend, and we have been discussing what we wanted to do with this program tonight. We have three topics in particular, and we have a lot of clips that we want to share with you tonight. The first hour, Michael Green is pretty much going to take the helm and discuss Muslims in Belgium. This is getting worse and worse and worse, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm going to let Michael set it up, and then I have a clip about radical Muslims in Belgium, and it is very scary. That will take the majority of the first hour. After that, we're going to literally talk cats and dogs, but mostly dogs, of course, Muslims and their relationship with our canine sentience. And then at the bottom of the hour, in the second hour, we will be discussing Israel. We have plenty of clips and plenty of topics. But with that, I do want to bring on Michael and wish him a wonderful evening. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Hey, Kel. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. Anytime. So how's your day going?
All is well, thank you.
We have a lot of material to get through, and you might have to do the majority of the talking because I explained that I've been losing my voice for about the last 4 days, and it's really, really bothering me. Lozenges aren't working, so you know what? I hope you're feeling loquacious tonight.
I'm up to the task.
There you go. So let's start with, give us a tee up. What exactly is it with Muslims, and what's going on in Belgium? And like I said, I have a clip here that I'll play a little later on.
First, let's get a little background. There's been a
yep.
huge influx of Muslims into the continent of Europe in the past 10 to 20 years, and they've settled in various countries and built these enclaves. And as these enclaves grow, they become more bold and demanding in regard to their Islamic culture and so-called religion. So we're now hearing very strong vocal statements of the Islamic community in the capital of Belgium, in Brussels, for Sharia law, as the same thing is manifesting in other European nations, such as the UK, certainly in France, areas of Scandinavia, Sweden, and Norway. But in this segment, we're going to focus on Belgium because they have a particularly pronounced problem with this. And
mm-hmm.
it's important to also be aware that the estimated population of Muslims in Belgium is currently at 650,000. And that's a very large number in relation to the size of the country. So right now they make about
6%.
Yeah, they make up about 6-7% of the overall population. Now, Belgium's not a very large country. What's more interesting is Belgium is home to the EU, and that's the European Union. So there's a lot there, you know, we can go with, seeing that the European Union, which has kind of been a failed experiment in many ways, but it does exist, and it's a bloc of European countries that have come together, and they attempt to have a certain level of influence in different things that take place on the global stage. So it's interesting that out of all the cities and, of course, countries in Europe, that Belgium in Brussels, you know, the capital, they have the more pronounced situation in terms of the Muslim population, comparatively speaking, to other European nations. So one might
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, you know, someone could think, well, you know, what's the big deal? I mean, you know, why would it be a problem if there are large concentrations of Islamic people settling in various Western nations? The problem is that when you study the history of Islam and you understand the teachings of its ideology, that all Muslims under the Sharia, there is a mandatory obligation to share and spread Islam. And there are, of course, different ways that it is done. It's done in a nonviolent way, which is kind of a stealth jihad. And, of course, we see and we know it's been done in a violent way and continues to. The main
Well, they're doing it through demographics and voting blocks. I don't know, Michael, if you can see the chat room, but there are people wondering, how are they going to achieve their caliphate? And what you said is absolutely correct. Demographics and voting blocks. We were warned about this many, many years ago.
Well, and we have to look at what set the stage for this. What set the stage was multiculturalism. Because if you go back a certain length of time, let's go back 50 years and further back than that, each respective nation has its own culture and heritage, and people should be proud of that particular culture and heritage. Multiculturalism is a very destructive situation, because what it does is that it then downgrades and actually pushes down the what was once the dominant culture of a respective country, and other cultures come in. And those cultures are, especially in regard to Islam, are very aggressive. And Islam seeks to dominate. It is not an ideology that seeks coexistence, certainly not with other religious beliefs, which would be Judaism, Christianity. Those are the two primary ones that we've seen in Europe. And then there's, of course, Buddhists and Hindus. But they're really not that much in the equation. You have to go to Asia, you know, where you see Buddhists and Hindus, and there's a big problem with Muslims and Islam, a lot of war and fighting. But in Europe, we have the Judeo-Christian values and system, you know, that is what built those countries. So Islam is attacking it, and one of the ways they're able to make inroads is by establishing these large enclaves and then making demands. Leftist-type socialist governments have enabled this. And I believe if those were not the type of governments that were ruling over in Western nations, that this could not have taken place. But that's not the case. The case is that that is exactly what we have in the West today, whether it's the United States, and although Canada is still fortunately has more of a conservative administration and certainly prime minister, but if we go and look over in Europe, we see leftist-type socialist governments that are very tolerant of Islam and Islamic culture and wanting to appease this culture and ideology and wanting to bend over backwards to accommodate them. Of course.
Absolutely. And all you have to do is listen to Tim Burton and myself on Red Fox Blogger and Radio Jihad Network. Tim writes prolifically about the Islamic threat. If you visit the BrennerBrief.com and click on Tim Burton, all the articles are there. What has been going on in Europe is phenomenal. I mean, I sit back in shock and awe some days. But You wanted to particularly concentrate on Belgium. Why is that?
Because there's a very strong movement within the capital for Sharia, and more so that about 30%, I think it's probably even up to a third now, a third of the population of Belgium is Islamic. So if you go and get, if you get on a plane and go to Belgium, go to Brussels, and walk around, you'll probably think you're in a Middle Eastern country. And once again, Europe is going back into the Dark Ages because Islam is part of the Dark Ages. You know, the way women are oppressed, the women have to wear certain coverings, the niqab, which is the face veil, the hijab, which is the headscarf, long gown-type garments, a lot of times in black. Very often their hands have to be covered. So this is disturbing because this is oppression, oppression of the female gender. So all this war took place. You know, we had two world wars, World War One and World War Two, and enormous sacrifices were made by people, you know, served in the military to bring freedom and democracy and free speech and to eliminate totalitarianism and fascism, Nazism. And tragically, Islam, Islamic fascism, as I like to identify it, I think it's appropriate, is now taking root in this area where we had the two greatest wars in the 20th century, World War One and World War Two.
You have been involved in the counter-jihad movement for a number of years, but you also do so much more. You're a pastor, and you are involved in charitable causes, helping wounded warriors and veterans. Explain to the listeners about the works that you do and your work in the ministry, and then we'll play a clip out of Belgium.
Well, I've been very blessed and fortunate for about 5 years to have had numerous opportunities to meet with combat wounded service members in the United States who had been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan and, of course, had sustained some pretty catastrophic wounds and were medevaced back here stateside and, you know, wound up at, well, one of the largest, if not the largest, military hospital in the U.S. And it's been a immensely rewarding experience, very inspiring and life-changing experience to have met so many of these courageous and, you know, heroic young men and some women, but primarily men, who've been on the battlefield, you know, and have faced the enemy in a literal sense. Because both wars, whether you agree with them or not, let's just look at the facts. The people that they were fighting, that our forces were fighting, okay, and also coalition nations like Canada and the UK, were Muslim fascists. You know, these people are Muslim terrorists. They have the same ideology. They are fighting for Allah. They believe in the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. Jihad is something they take literal. So it kind of ties in to my other area of strong interest, and that is, you know, the counter-jihad movement. And I think this experience of almost 5 years strengthened my resolve and desire to make some valuable contribution in counter-jihad after seeing so many catastrophically, you know, wounded people and knowing that those wounds were inflicted by those adherents and believers in Islamic fascism.
And they're cowardly as well. They're cowards. They don't wear uniforms. They don't abide by the Geneva Convention. And they don't show their arms openly, their rifles, whatever, openly, like is subscribed by the Geneva Convention. What they do is that they're farmers by day and jihadists by night, and they're cowards. They plant IEDs at the side of the road, and they literally are blowing earth soldiers up.
Well, also, they indiscriminately slaughter civilians because, you know, huge numbers, massive numbers of civilians have been maimed and killed in Afghanistan especially, and, you know, in Iraq too. But the Iraq war, for all intents and purposes, ended in 2011 mistakenly. That's another area.
Yeah.
But just to focus on Afghanistan, because that's where our forces have been since 2009, sure. I mean, the Taliban and al-Qaeda hold the same ideology, and they have no problem, no compunction with killing and maiming Afghan civilians.
I have been involved in this counter-jihadist movement myself for a number of years, probably about the same time as you. But you do so much more. You're an ordained pastor. That was something new to me. I learned that just today. What called you to God and that you would be ordained?
Well, it's a long story, but I think all Christians, we should give credit and acknowledgement to our Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, and, of course, to God, our Father, in turning our life, you know, towards Him and putting us on that path. I felt called to go into the ministry X amount of years ago, and then that part of my life took a direction in regard to wounded warriors in America. And that was the kind of pinnacle of it because, you know, when you deal with people who are facing life and death, it really can't get any more serious than that. And I have friends who've lost family members, you know, in both wars. They call them in the States Gold Star families, Gold Star mothers or dads or Gold Star brothers or sisters. So it is of the utmost seriousness, you know, and it's a tremendous blessing to be able to, you know, share the Christian faith with people like this. You know, I believe we all benefit from the teachings of Christ, but certainly the love and comfort and strength that we can receive if we're going through massive challenges, you know, if we've lost, you know, limbs or been blinded, disfigured, burned, psychological trauma from being in combat, seeing your brothers die in front of you, seeing people blown up. The horrors of war, you know, dismemberment of human beings, death and destruction, it does something to a human being. It changes them. You know, anyone who's been in combat, been on the battlefield, comes back forever changed in one respect or another.
Indeed. What I'm going to do right now is I'm going to play a clip, and this is Radical Muslims in Belgium. Michael Green has quite the expertise in this area. So we're going to play this. And Michael, I have some questions for you when we get back.
Militant Islam appears to be spreading its influence to more and more European towns and cities. Here in Brussels, a Muslim woman journalist, using her veil as a disguise, infiltrated the Muslim community and found so many radicalized young people, men and women, ready to use violence in their cause. Well, the book the journalist Hind Fryer has written, which is called Undercover in Little Morocco, has shocked Belgium to the core. We went out to some of the same areas to take a look for ourselves. This is Hind Fraihi, a 30-year-old journalist. Her parents come from Morocco, but she considers herself a Belgian through and through. She was born and raised in a small Flemish town, where she also went to school and had her first job. Hind speaks fluent Arabic and has written much about the lives of Muslims in what is called the Dar al-Harb, the non-Islamic world. Her recent book about the rise of Muslim extremism in Belgium has attracted a great deal of attention. Her theory is that young Muslims of both sexes, between 15 and 25 years of age, are becoming increasingly radicalized. They reject Western values. Even their parents are alarmed.
These parents often say, "I see my son or even my daughter becoming so radicalized. I don't understand it."
Fraihi says Muslim extremism is a phenomenon of youth, and it is increasingly appealing to women.
I spoke with several women, radical Muslimas, whose highest ideal is to marry a Muslim warrior. We call these women jihad brides. Here in the Molenbeek district of Brussels, more than a third of the residents are Muslims from North Africa. Hind spent 2 months living and researching here, undercover, posing as a sociology student, in order to learn more about Islamist extremism. On market day, the streets are full of people. Many stop to chat. The mood seems friendly and pleasant, but it's obvious that the police presence has been increasing. The authorities are aware of a rising potential for violence in the area. Suddenly, we're told we're unwelcome. This man tells us to stop filming, warning us in no uncertain terms that he'll get violent if we don't get out of here right away. The bystanders are also upset. We move on in an attempt to defuse the situation. But the man follows us, and a short while later, we have another run-in with him. He tells us to take away the camera. He tells us we have no rights and can only film if he allows it. Belgian laws do not interest him. The man is confident that it is he who controls the neighborhood. Molenbeek's police station is located hardly 100 meters away. Many police officers are afraid that the state no longer wields authority here, at least not the sole authority. They know that Islamists view Molenbeek as subject only to Muslim law. Many of the older men despair and call these young people a lost generation. But no one wants to say it on camera. It's too dangerous to get into a fight with them. These men are arguing the rules of coexistence. Our camera is a provocation. Its mere presence seems to call into question who makes the rules here. With much effort, 5 police officers are able to calm everybody down. They know the situation in the area is very tense, but they're not supposed to say it out loud. Hinfra Yihi is trying to break this taboo. She wants to stop the growing influence of the radical Islamists. It's a problem which has gone beyond just a few cities. This is no longer just a phenomenon in cities. It's long since reached rural areas, and not just in Europe, but worldwide. It's getting worse all the time. More and more young people in small towns, even in farming villages, are being infected by these extremist ideas. Hind believes the Arabic language media play a major role. They can be received via satellite even in the smallest hamlets. In the propaganda they broadcast, religion is not a private matter. All of life is being Islamized, says Hind. For her, religion is a private matter and no substitute for politics. She thinks Muslim women should be able to wear headscarves in the mosque, but not on the street.
Well, what do you say about that? This is in Belgium, and passers-by being threatened with violence if they engage in anything which could be as innocuous as filming a fruit stand. Michael, what do you think about this?
Well, there's other things we can add to this very serious problem here in Brussels. For example, rapes in Belgium are way up, and it's been determined that the perpetrators of these horrific acts are Muslim men. And, of course, that's happened in other European nations. But right now, of course, we'll stay focused on Belgium, Brussels, the capital. There are two men who are politicians. They are Muslim politicians, and they have won municipal elections in Brussels, and they have vowed to implement the Sharia. So, you know, when you have an Islamist who actually is now been elected to some type of political office, and, of course, through that they can try to exert influence and so forth. Yeah, Brussels is a frightening city. As I said earlier, that, you know, if you're in this city, you probably think you might be somewhere in the Middle East. You might feel that, like, you're in Mecca or some other Islamist nation, you know, that's got this backward Stone Age culture where women walk around almost covered in head to toe in black veils, and, you know, the men wear the traditional Islamic clothing. And as you said, this is the problem with these people, is that they are violent fascists, and they will threaten violence upon those if they do something that they feel is not in accordance with their so-called religion and culture. So they're a very dangerous group of people to have within your nation once they get that critical mass number.
I'm very good friends with a person named Paul Austin Murphy, and he is a terror expert, and he sent me an article. I posted something on my Facebook page, so he sent me his latest article, and it's not his latest. It's an archived article, and my post on my Facebook page was, there was a poll on a Toronto radio station about, do you think that there will ever be peace in the Middle East? And they had yes, no, maybe so, whatever, Jolly Wally Pepper, doesn't matter. 100% said no. So I posted that on my Facebook page. And he posted this in my feed. This is a glossary of Islamic words used by Muslims. Peace. What happens when the entire world submits to Islam? Justice, what only full Sharia law can bring about, or justice to and for Muslims, for example, the creation of Sharia law in the UK and elsewhere. Rights, the right of Muslims to practice Sharia law, or the right of Muslims to follow various Sharia laws. Freedom, what only full Sharia law can bring about, the freedom to be a Muslim, the freedom to follow Sharia law, ban the EDL, or the satanic verses, the Danish cartoons, the innocence of Islam, etc., impose Sharia blasphemy laws on the West. Islamic knowledge meaning knowledge of Islam, the Quran, the Hadith, etc., truth. What the Quran, Muhammad, the Hadith, etc., say is the truth. It's the Islamic truth. Science. Anything Islam accepts as science, but not human evolution, the Big Bang, or any other science which contradicts Islam. I could go on and on and on. This page on the site in particular has so many. But it's quite clear, Michael, that Islam is Islam. It's rigid, it's unmoving, but they're moving in. They're taking over the neighborhood. And what you were aforementioning about what's going on in Belgium is frightening. And looking at this video, I was frightened by it. I was also noting some of the comments, though, from the YouTube video. And one that came across me as being rather striking is that somebody said, there's a Muslim problem because your liberal governments allowed it. What do you think about that, Michael?
Well, that fits perfectly with my previous statement that a liberal leftist atmosphere in any Western nation will greatly help to facilitate the fascist movement of Islam because of tolerance and acceptance. It's astounding, actually, because you don't have to be a PhD individual, you know, a highly educated person with many degrees, to do some basic research and learn rather quickly that Islam is not tolerant of other belief systems, and they certainly is not tolerant of Western values. Islam is diametrically opposed to freedom and democracy because under the Sharia, there is no freedom. You must adhere to this Islamic law. It's barbaric. It's oppressive. and there's no flexibility. And the goal of these Muslim fascists is to implement the Sharia. And, of course, to have a majority rule within a Western nation for the express purpose of taking over it, and ultimately Islam becomes the law of the land. And the Sharia is the is the set of laws that will govern that land or area where you have the Muslim population. Even if you have people who are non-Islamic, Muslims are very disingenuous. You know, you speak to them. I've spoken to numerous Muslims, and I've asked them, well, what if we have people who are non-Muslim and they live in an area where Muslims rule and dominate? You know, do they have anything to be concerned about? And, of course, they'll say, no, they don't. They say the Sharia is not applicable to a non-Muslim. That's a blatant lie. All we have to do is look at the history. You know, there's something called the Golden Age of Islam, and it's really a myth, because Jews and Christians did not live that well under Muslim rule. They weren't all slaughtered, but they were called dhimmis. You know, they were second-class citizens. They had to pay the jizya, the humiliation tax.
Yeah.
It was very clear how they could conduct themselves, what they could and couldn't do. So living under Islamic rule for a non-Muslim can be a horrifying experience. So there's no tolerance at all. The word Islam, if you study the Arabic, it's derived from the word submission. Anyone that says Islam means peace doesn't know the Arabic language. It actually means submission, and submission to Allah.
Of course it
and,
does.
And the Prophet Muhammad.
That's why Theo Van Gogh made that documentary called Submission. And he had a lot of blowback for that from the Islamic community, and we know what happened to Theo Van Gogh in the end. He was stabbed in the streets and virtually beheaded.
Well, you see, the danger is when you have a large concentration of Islamic people in a Western nation, especially a Western nation that is very liberal, a Western nation that does not allow its citizens to lawfully own firearms for self-defense, a Western nation that will bend over backwards, you know, and cave into the pressure from the Islamic community and keep appeasing them and allow them to go further and further with their demands, you know. There's so many stories you could tell. Years ago, I met a family from Australia in America who were visiting, and they told me that in their community in Australia, I think it was somewhere around Melbourne, within the public school system, there was a group of Muslims, not many at that time, and they wanted separate swimming classes for the Muslim students. And they insisted that their children, who are Muslim, should not have to get into a pool with non-Muslims. And this is back quite a number of years ago, before Australia became inundated with a large invasion of Islamic people. And that's just one little story of what you see when Muslim communities start to grow and build out, especially in an environment, like I said, where you have a multiculturalist type liberal atmosphere, and where you have a situation where the citizens are not permitted to lawfully defend themselves. Muslims feel much more emboldened to become violent, like Paris, which is a perfect example. If you just look at the riots, the violent savagery of these, you know, Jew-hating, Israel-hating Islamists that have gone in the streets of Paris and, you know, raised hell, and they're burning cars and burning shops and, you know, trying to assault people, and extreme violence. And this is the mentality of the Muslim.
Yeah.
It's a mob mentality.
We're seeing this in Canada as well. It's becoming more and more pronounced. We had the Jewish Defense League protesting the Palestinian House in Toronto a couple of weeks back, and these so-called fails, and we're going to be discussing that one a little later on, ladies and gentlemen, but just for edification, we had the so-called Palestinians. They were raising their flags, and they. What really bothered me, though, is that they also had Canadian flags, but they were using the poles as truncheons, and they were beating up the peaceful people, the peaceful protesters, and it was peaceful, ladies and gentlemen. If you Google Palestine House Israel, no, actually the better way to do it, if you want to Google and see some of these videos, just Palestine House Canada Jewish Defense League, and you'll get all sorts of videos coming up. They were peacefully protesting at the Palestine House, which, by the way, has been defunded by the Canadian government, might I add. And we're seeing it in Canada, Michael, and it's disturbing. What's going on in the UK frightens me. Like I say, folks, listen to Tim Burton and Jeff Mitchell of EDO Radio. They'll tell you what's going on right now over there. And, Michael, you have been concentrating on Belgium. It's frightening, that clip I played. You can't even take your cam recorder out anymore.
Yeah, let me get back to Brussels. Let me share a few facts with your audience. As I said earlier, rape is on the increase, and there's approximately 5 new rape cases each week in Brussels, and that's very alarming. And it's coming from the Islamic community. And very often the targets of these sexual assaults are non-Muslim women. Because basically, if you really look at the teachings of Islam, and there are Muslim clerics or scholars or Islamic people who might deny this, but the facts are that a non-Muslim woman, especially if she's uncovered, you know, if she's not wearing the hijab or other Islamic coverings, that, you know, she's kind of an open target to be sexually assaulted, and that the sexual assault is not necessarily the fault of the perpetrator of the male, you know, the Muslim. It's because the woman had the audacity to go outside and not, you know, walk around with like a potato sack over her. So, you know, they'll hold the female responsible. And the way you can see proof of that is you just look at the fact that in many Islamic countries, if a woman is raped, she must produce 4 male witnesses, which makes it almost impossible for a conviction of the rapist. And then she'll be accused of adultery, even though she was forcibly raped. And, of course, in certain countries like Somalia and Iran, Afghanistan, sometimes in Pakistan, and certainly in Saudi Arabia, she'll be stoned to death. That's the punishment under the Sharia. Any faithful Muslim, incomprehensible. Yeah. Well, you know, most Muslims that are really following Islam, they really have no choice. I'm not giving them an out or an excuse, but I'm just making a statement that they'll tell you that under the Sharia, if a woman does commit an act of adultery, and most of these women are not necessarily adulteresses, you know, what they'll do is they'll say, well, this is the law of Allah, and it was given through the Prophet Muhammad, and therefore the punishment is as such. I had a Muslim man tell me once that that woman, if she was stoned to death, was actually doing better, because then she could go to paradise, because she paid for her sin on the earth. And, you know, here you're brutally killing a human being in a savage way, and now Allah will supposedly accept her because, you know, she's paid her punishment. It's interesting because in the Christian faith it's completely opposite. First of all, we don't believe we have the right. Yeah, we are not the judge and jury and executor of God's laws in that respect. If a person breaks the law of the land, yes, they must be punished. But, you know, Jesus came to forgive. He came to teach about remission and repentance and about love and compassion. And Muhammad came for everything opposite of that. He came for judgment, for brutality, for very little mercy at all under Islamic law. And there's a great story, and I always tell it to Muslims, in the Bible when Christ came upon Mary, who had been accused of adultery. Actually, she was caught in the act of adultery, and all these Jews, the Pharisees, had stones in their hand, and they were about to kill her, stone her to death. And Christ, he turned to them and he said, "Any of you who has no sin, then cast the first stone." And they were all convicted because we're all sinners, you know, none of us are perfect. And they threw their stones down,
yeah,
and they walked away. And it's just a beautiful story of how Christ, he said to this young girl, he said, "Well, your sins are now forgiven, but go and sin no more." And now, you know, if you look at Islam and you take the same story and circumstances, that young lady would have been brutally killed by being stoned to death, which, by the way, is a horrific way to die.
It's interesting. We have a comment from the chat room, and this comes from Bigfoot. And actually, I have one from Holger I'd like to relate as well. But Bigfoot says, under that law, the man was supposed to be stoned too, but they only presented the woman.
Well, yeah, I mean, under the law, if you look in the Torah is the first five books of the Bible. The Torah was the law given to God to Moses. And there were some harsh punishments in there. Certainly there were. That's where actually Islam gets a lot of this stuff. They took parts of the Old Testament and the New Testament, and they perverted it. You know, they distorted it. They twisted it around. And, you know, they use it to intimidate people, to brutalize them, and to ultimately control them. But, yes, the man is supposed to be stoned, too. But it's interesting, if you look at the history in Islamic countries where this is permissible, very rarely is the man put to death. I mean, it does happen, but
and
it's a very small percentage.
What I understand as well is that if a man is sentenced to stoning, that he can have an out in the sense in that he's only buried up to the waist and his arms are exposed, in which he is able to dig himself out, and if he escapes, he is exonerated of his crime, whereas we know the women, they are bound and they are put in the ground up to their shoulders where they have absolutely no recourse.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, you know, a woman, there's a great video on YouTube. I have to kind of promote it because it's very riveting and it's disturbing, not because it's graphic, but because the way it was produced. It has over a million views. It's called She's Buried Chest High. It was actually produced by a young lady who was formerly a Muslim. And it goes through this whole situation we're discussing and the brutality of how they'll take a female. And it could be a girl, even 13 years old. There was a situation in Somalia. This poor 13-year-old girl was gang-raped by these savages, and she was brutally stoned to death. And they had some supposed nurse there to check if she actually was dead, you know, had died. And it turned out she was still alive and breathing somewhat, and they continued to stone her until she was dead. So
I suggest people watch this. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's a very center part of Islam, the Sharia. And within the Sharia is this punishment. And it is not negotiable under the true teachings of Islam. And once again, once there is a majority rule, you know, when you have an Islamist state. Now, of course, Egypt's not an Islamist state, and Libya was not an Islamist state, and neither was Iraq. Saudi Arabia is an Islamist state. Iran, you could say, they're not pure Islamist states, thank God, but they are more so. Afghanistan, parts of Pakistan. That's why, you know, people in the West need to be very concerned when they hear of Muslims in their country standing up and demanding for the Sharia and making statements that they want the Sharia to be permitted to be within that nation.
And I don't understand why our respective governments are allowing this. And I said that Holger made a very, very good point in the chat room, and that is that Jesus spent 33 years on earth and never took a woman. Muhammad defiled a 9-year-old girl. How basic can it get? What is wrong with us in that we are offering allowances to a perversion. And this is not a religion. This is a political movement. Don't you think, Michael?
Yeah, I would. It's a fascist movement because in true fascism, there is no freedom. And
mm-hmm.
that ideology, that fascist ideology, controls. And it uses violence and physical intimidation, torture, and death, of course, imprisonment, floggings, whippings, and all these things, to administer its control by fear. Now, if you look up the definition of the word religion in the dictionary, the word benevolent is usually there. It'll say some type of spiritual ideology or spiritual path connected to a god, a creator god, and in a benevolent way. Now, I've yet to see the benevolence of Islam. So, no, I could not see Islam as a religion in the sense, you know, that we know there are other religions. There are spiritual beliefs that people hold on how they can have a relationship with a God who is the creator of all things. And, you know, I ask Muslims all the time when I speak to them in person, well, if God, if Allah created all these things, then how could they be so bad? For example, Jews, you know, there's great hatred of Jews taught in the Quran and the Hadith. You know, I've done a lot of research on it, and it's extensive. There's a particular animus against Jews within Islam, more pronounced than any other group of people. That is why you see intense hatred of Jews in relation to the situation in Israel. I know we're going to get into later in the program, but there's
mm-hmm.
a direct connection to what Islam puts forth in regard to the Jewish people. Not just people who live in Israel,
yeah.
who they hate. They hate Zionists, of course, but it just kind of covers Jews in general.
We're going to take a break in about 3 minutes, but I want you to wrap up your points about what is going on in Belgium in particular. And we have something that we want to play for you, ladies and gentlemen. Michael, help me pick this out. So go ahead, Michael.
Well, as I was stating earlier, in Brussels, the capital, there's a very serious problem manifesting. Close to a third of the population is Islamic. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Muslims. There is actually a political party within Brussels now. It's called the Islam Party, and it advocates the implementation of the Sharia. And with that would be the suppression of the freedoms that people have had, you know, in this Western European nation. Also, we have to realize that the birth rate is way down amongst non-Muslim people in Europe, and this is a problem, and, you know, it's more detailed for another program, but Muslims are specifically being encouraged to have large families for the purpose of ultimately overtaking. I can tell you a story in America where there's a man I know who is an accountant, and he's not a Muslim, but he has a Muslim client who is an imam of a mosque. And he went to visit the imam for some business. And while he's waiting for the imam, he went to view various literature that was available within this mosque. And in some of this literature, it clearly stated that Islamic families are expected to have many children with the hopes of one day having a number of somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 million Islamic people in the U.S. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but I'm just using it as an example. So Muslims are intentionally having large families and ironically using the Western system, you know, of the social programs of the countries they hate, mind you, of people who work hard and
mm-hmm.
pay taxes, and they're benefiting from that because there's no way they could sustain these families, you know, feed and clothe them and house them with the kind of income they might be earning. So they're using the system. They're using the system implemented, and these idiot leftist and liberal imbeciles allowing these people to do something for the purpose of ultimately destroying them. You know, would you put a loaded weapon in the hand of your enemy if you knew that within a number of years he would take that weapon and put it to your head and pull the trigger?
No, absolutely not. And that would be a very, 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 very compelling discussion. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, I am moderator for a brand new show that is on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time called Islam Exposed. And the focus of that particular show is the issues of our governments, our respective governments. We have three radio hosts from three different countries, and we hold our respective governments' feet to the fire. Michael, I think that you would be more than welcome to join us for that, as that would be a very, very good topic discussion. But what I want to do right now is I do want to take that break, but before we do, I want to acknowledge people that are listening in the chat room and listening in the studio. First of all, to remind you, you're listening to Kel Fritzie of the Red Fox Blogger, and my friend, Michael Green. Pastor Michael Green is joining me tonight. In the studio joining us is Sweet Sue from New Mexico. And moving forward, in the chat room, we have Agador, we have Bigfoot, Cal Living, Cat Strangler 101, who, of course, is Tim Burton, meow. We have some guests joining us. Hold Your Awaken, Paul Alexander, Southern Senses, Conservative Sense, and that's my Annie. And Vorpal Bite. We've had people pop in and people pop out. And Bigfoot, thank you very much for putting the link to your blog in the chat room. Everybody, please, if you have a show or a blog, please put them in there. But I also want to do this. I have to apprise people. This is citizen journalism. Hold Your's show, as you're used to hearing, at 10 p.m. Eastern Time has been moved an hour ahead. Hold Your Awaken, The Awakening, will now be heard Saturdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. But this is something, please be there tomorrow night, because this is going to be one heck of a show. This is Hold Your's reunion, and I'll let Hold Your speak for himself.
Blog Talk Radio is an interesting and dynamic place. Not only are there shows for every interest, but the hosts and the listeners are constantly changing. While there are many good things that come with change, the downside is that some of the shows we get to know and love also fade away. Hold Your Awakens at The Awakening has decided to bring back a couple of Blog Talk Radio hosts who have been favored by those of us on the right side of society for a reunion show. On Saturday, July 26th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, Holger will be hosting Diane Student of the Freedom's Wings Show and Doc Wythe of the Conservative Underground Show for a look at the politics and issues around the nation. And with any luck, we'll be treated to Diane's signature chat room chill out.
Hello, flight crew. This is your captain speaking. I know you have those grass skirts wrapped up in mothballs somewhere. It's time to drag them out. Time to drag out those coconuts as well. Come on, drinks all around. It's time for a chat room chill out.
So join us on July 26th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for this great show that's sure to be loved by all of us that love these great hosts.
And please do try to be at Hold Your Awakens. Blog Talk Radio is so much more than people on the air. Blog Talk Radio is a family. We have cliches and clicks and this and that, but we are so much more. Blog Talk Radio is intimate, and we really stick with each other. And Holger is bringing back some very beloved radio hosts that are on hiatus And so I'm very excited about this. And just to remind you, once again, ladies and gentlemen, Hold Your Awakens, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, okay? So you guys be there tomorrow night, all right? If I don't see you there, I'm personally going to hunt you down, all right? And you don't want a mad fox after you. When I get mad, I am rabies ridden. I am so happy, though, that Diane's student is going to be on the program tonight. Oh, and Holger also apprised me that Dana Smearman is also going to be on Reactionary Speaks Network right after my, well, his show is starting now, but you guys, when I am finished here, you know where I'm going next. That's right. Reactionary Speaks Network, heard right here on Blog Talk Radio and other fine places, as it were. But what I want to do right now is that, Michael, you sent me a beautiful, beautiful song. And this is for the soldiers. This is an American soldier. And Michael, do you want to set this one up?
Sure, thanks. This particular piece of music was written and composed, put together to focus on what not just American soldier, you know, anyone who's been on the battlefield, and let's look at the past 12 to 13 years of war, because we are focusing on Islamic fascism, you know, the Islamic terrorism that's happened all over this globe. And these young men and some women have gone on the battlefield and encountered these people. Many of them didn't make it home from our respective countries. Those that did have been, you know, changed forever physically, either, you know, loss of limbs, disfigured, burned, and, you know, the psychological and emotional trauma of being at war. So I believe it's of the utmost importance to give acknowledgement and respect to these people, and also to understand that, thank God, you know, that throughout the course of history, and especially the 20th century, that, you know, people have been answering the call to arms and willing to literally put their life on the line to preserve the freedom that we have. And Islamic fascism is a direct threat to that freedom.
And this song is called American Son, and this is by James Halen. It's a very long, well, it's not very, very long, but it's longer than what I usually play. But I think this is important. When you listen to the opening, you'll understand everything. I think this is beautiful. And, Michael, I want to thank you for sending this to Red Fox Blogger. People, please listen to the very beginning and understand what is going on.
Troops mistreated and also misdiagnosed. We got our hands on an audio tape which first surfaced on Salon.com. It features the voice of an Army psychologist and was secretly recorded by a soldier at Fort Carson, Colorado. On it, Douglas McNinch says that he's been pressured not to diagnose soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorder and to label them instead with anxiety disorder. That could result in the wrong treatments, also lower disability payments, or no payments at all. Listen to the sound.
Wake up and it's only 3 a.m. and I can't smoke a cigarette. I can't have any light shining. Try and keep them crosshairs off my head. Head out on night patrol through a bad little town that I don't know. I'm kicking in doors, it's just a day's chore. It's all routine to U.S. Marines. Another night of green glowing like like I'd never seen. There was a 10-hour firefight. They hit my Humvee, blew out my knee. But I got scars that no eye could see. They got Tommy burning in a Bradley. And so I called in an airstrike. I turned the city block down a burning rock. Now I wake alive, think about that fight. Now I'm all stretched thin, just like an old man never been. I'm staying in to win this war. It's close quarters and I follow orders. It's my third tour of this war. And you don't want me to write this policy. Or a general with four stars. Instead I'm sent by man with five deferments, riding around in a bulletproof car. A soldier sent back home, they're trying to dine alone. The memory of two diseases. Nothing new and no surprise, so I feel bad for the poor family. My quarters in from Rome, the change gon' bring me home. I don't talk much about what I've done. The hurting never ends, well I'm just fighting for my friends. I'm a mean man with a gun. I'm a real American son. And trust me, sir, you don't want none.
And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Red Fox Blogger. I am your host, Kel Fritzy. And Michael Green, my friend. He's not a guest. He's my friend. And Michael, I want to thank you very much for contributing that to the radio program tonight. I put the link in the chat room for everybody so that they can go to YouTube. And while that was playing, I was watching the video. I had it on mute, of course, on YouTube. This moves me. I mean, the men and women in our military, whether it be in the United States, Canada, the UK, Australia, wherever in the West, the work and the dedication that they do should never, ever leave you in doubt that these are committed individuals that have one common goal, and that is to protect you and me. That the soldiers are being treated so unfairly by the U.S. Administration under the usurper Barack Hussein Obama. And Michael Green, the work that you do helping the wounded warriors and veterans, you're tireless. And welcome back, Michael. I better pass the mic to you.
Thanks, Kel. I want to make a comment about that piece of music. I came across it a number of months ago, and as I sat and listened to it for the first time, it had a profound effect on me because I've been fortunate. I'm not anyone special. I just feel blessed and fortunate to have spent the past 5 years with so many of these heroes. And the words in that song are brutally honest. That's what, you know, people in the military, like you said, not just Americans, that's what they go through. You know, they see their buddies getting shot, blown up, burning in a vehicle, you know, that's been hit by an IED. They come back with the seen and unseen scars of war. Unfortunately, in the U.S., this government doesn't do much for them. Thank God we have a lot of charitable organizations that, you know, have done tremendous things to return something. At the end of the day, you know, you can never really repay someone who has gone off to the battlefield. But what they want is a sincere thank you. They want to know that the people back home support them and they think about them, they're praying for them, their safe return for their families. And that's what's most important to them, not any grandiose type things. They're just basically very humble people who, as you said, are committed to protecting the freedoms that each of our nations have. And all these freedoms have never been inherited. They have to be fought for from generation to generation. That's the fact of the world. Since mm-hmm. the beginning of the existence of the human race, man has been at war. And I believe we will be until the culmination of, you know, this world. And thank God there are people that answer that call and are willing to risk life and limb, you know, to protect the freedoms that we do have.
Oh, yeah.
And Islamic fascism, and this is the tie-in to the program and to the counter-jihad movement, is a direct threat to these freedoms. As we learned in our segment before, you know, we focused on what's going on in just one place, and that's in Brussels, the capital of Belgium. And it is. So the jihad movement, I believe, is operating on three fronts. It is a physical warfare, and we know about that. It is a stealth jihad, a nonviolent movement within Western nations to spread Islam. And then the third front would be the social media, and that's in YouTube, Twitter, and certainly Facebook, where there is a very aggressive movement to promote jihad. So those are the three things that the West is facing in this very consequential time that we're in.
I want to just let people know that we had somebody grace our chat room, and that is Underground Professor, who has his own prolific radio program heard right here on Blog Talk Radio and other fun devices. And what you're saying, Michael, underground professor is agreeing wholeheartedly. It's not only the Islamic threat, it's the welfare. We touched upon what they do, the Mohammedans, what they're capable of doing with taking advantage of our generous social safety nets. And underground professor radio, he said, I am not treated fairly when the people I pay for with my taxes live a better life than I do. And that's true, and that's totally unfair.
The system in the West is set up to provide assistance for people who are in need, and it's abused. And people from the Islamic community avail themselves of these benefits. And what's wrong with that is that their agenda is to hopefully see one day these Western nations dominated by Islam. And that's a serious situation we're facing, especially in countries like the U.K., you know, my good friend Tim Burton and others who live in England, they have very serious things they're facing with this infiltration. And they're very committed and they're very organized.
Oh, pardon me, sorry.
Yeah, the Islamist movement is a very committed movement amongst its followers, and it's a very organized movement. So we, if we're going to oppose it lawfully, I must stress lawfully, we must also be very committed and very organized and hope that more people will understand that it's a serious threat. You know, it's interesting. People don't wake up until something comes to their doorstep. But, just look at what's happening in Brussels. Isn't that a warning sign? I would say it's a pretty prominent warning sign to the West. We just hope that more people will wake up.
We're going to switch gears right now because there was something that we wanted to discuss. And we were talking about this on the phone, and people don't seem to understand exactly why the Mohammedans despise dogs. And you wanted to touch on that before we move into our final segment, that being of Israel and what's going on over there right now. But why do Mohammedans hate our canine sentience?
Well, first let me say, for anyone that's ever owned a dog or had one in their family or a family member that's had one or someone or been around a dog, I don't see how you can't just absolutely not fall in love with these creatures. They're so loyal. They're, you know, it's unconditional love. They bring enormous companionship and joy and just positive things into our life. I believe our God created them for a very specific purpose. If you look at the animal kingdom, the dog has bonded with man way beyond any other animal-human relationship. And, you know, that is chronicled throughout the history of the world. So when we look into Islam and into the Quran and the Hadith and what Muhammad said about dogs, and then we can look at how dogs are treated in Islamic countries, it paints a very dark picture, a very disturbing picture, because first of all, an animal is not able to really defend itself against a human being for obvious reasons. And so to abuse an animal is a heinous act. It truly is. But let me give a little background to the audience. For example, that the Messenger of Allah, he said, whoever acquires a dog, with the exception of a dog to act as a guard of livestock, a hunting dog, or a farm dog, will have the reward that he shall receive spiritually, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, deducted from him. So it is absolutely forbidden in the teachings of Islam for a Muslim to own a dog, because a dog is considered najas, which in Arabic means unclean. So only one condition provides for a Muslim to have a dog, and that is that the dog, first of all, expressly must be kept outside of the home, because it's also taught, as it reads, it says, I heard as the Apostle of Allah, peace be upon him, he had said, the angels of mercy shall not enter into the house wherein there is a dog, And then it continues, it says, a picture of a living creature, a human, and that's in a hadith, the Bukhari. So I have been told numerous times in my community that Muslims have said, well, you know, under no circumstances can you have a dog in your home because the angels of God will not come into your house. Now, this is absurd. It's rubbish. You know, it's absolute nonsense. But more important, Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I want you to elaborate on that.
I'm sorry, which point?
Why is it that, what happened in that Muhammad declared that dogs were haram?
First of all, Muhammad made a declaration that all black dogs were to be killed because he believed that they were possessed by jinns, that's a devil, some kind of evil spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So the etiquette or decree did not apply to all dogs. It certainly applied to dogs with black fur. That's a superstitious, idiotic way of thinking. And so that's where that kind of began. I cannot tell you at this juncture the exact circumstance that, you know, what happened with Muhammad and a dog that prompted him to have this belief. But then Muhammad had a lot of very demented and sick beliefs. So, you know, what's the underlying cause of this thinking? I can't nail it down right now. I can just tell you that certainly Islam is pretty clear that dogs are unclean. They're najas. And if a Muslim comes in contact with a dog, they must go through a ritual washing procedure. And it's quite absurd. They have to use soil from the ground, and they have to do this cleansing or ablution at least 7 times. And, you know, there's this whole routine and way it has to be done very specifically if they're going to be kind of cleansed of this filth, as they would call it. Now, look at the irony here. Within Islam, there are teachings, not to be crude, but that Muslims use a particular hand, actually their left hand, to cleanse themselves. I'm sure everyone can figure out what that means. Now, any dog I've ever owned or ever known, I find them very clean and sanitary animals. You know, when they have to do what they have to do, they do it, and it's done, and they're not, you know, they don't use their paw to cleanse themselves, if you understand what I'm saying. So here you have Islam saying that the dog is unclean, but yet they will use a certain Islamic procedure to clean a certain area of their body. Do you see any contradiction there?
And and their ablutions are not very, not very complete, shall I say?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, let me share something with the audience. Okay? And like I said, not to be crude, but we need to know the facts and we need to know the truth about what Islam teaches. So there is information on the Internet, and there is etiquette for how a Muslim is supposed to use the bathroom and what he's supposed to do in the bathroom, and there's very involved stuff about praying, and if you use the toilet, you cannot face Mecca, you know, and the Kaaba and all this nonsense. But anyway, it says here, it says one should remove the feces from that area of your body with one's finger and wash one's hand. And then it talks about more detailed stuff. It's not even getting into. So I find it ironic that a Muslim would actually tell me that my dog is unclean when, you know, they're using their bare hands.
Or that are stones. I don't think they've ever squeezed the Charmin, let's put it that way.
Well, you know, look, it's backward and it's nasty. You know, you want to talk about unhygienic. In my research on this topic, I also discovered that according to Islamic teachings, that the saliva of a dog contains microscopic worms, and they said science proved that. Now, of course, you know, if you take science and put it side by side Islam, we know who the winner there is. But, you know, it's absurd, again, another asinine, inaccurate statement coming from Islam that, you know, dogs have microscopic worms in their mouth. Now, anyone's been around a dog, you know, a dog come up to you and lick you. It's a sign of affection and whatnot. And But anyway, let me tell the audience, and I don't think we've ever discussed this. I want to relay an interesting story. I came upon a Islamic person about a year ago, and he gleefully and joyfully told me that in his country, which was an African Muslim country, that killing and torturing dogs was part of their culture, and, you know, that it's done with enjoyment. Now, at the time, I had my dog with me, a rather large-sized dog, and he kept looking at my dog, and I looked at him. And I went around this particular business, and the snout of my dog inadvertently touched a crate, a wooden crate that contained watermelons. And he literally flipped out, and he said that all the watermelon had to be thrown out now, you know, because it was now haram, because the dog nose, I think for a second or two, actually touched this crate. Didn't even touch the fruit, but who cares if it did. So anyway, things kind of escalated, and they got pretty nasty, and I just had to clearly advise him that any attempt or thought of him to harm my dog would put him in a very unhealthy position. I won't get into detail what I did have to say, but I had to make it clear that it would not be a wise thing under any circumstance. But that is a good example of the mentality of these savages, because they are savages. I mean, any human being that gets pleasure from torturing or killing an animal, especially a dog, I mean, with such wonderful creatures, is quite evil. And
absolutely.
Anybody that has a dog, and if you do own a dog and you walk that dog around an area where there are any Islamic people, it's interesting to see their reaction. You know, they will they'll practically cross the street to get away from the dog. But what I like to do is I like to bring my dog up near them, because I think dogs are great for children, and they just kind of get all freaked out and everything, and it really kind of rattles their cage. But I've always said that the rear end of a dog actually could be considered cleaner than most areas of their body.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? I want to relate a story. I have always had dogs in the household. My home is not right without a dog, and everybody that listens to the Red Fox Blogger knows that. I lost my dog of 14 years in May, and the house was empty. It was very, very sad. And so we have since adopted Dobby Amba from the Humane Society. But when we brought Brandy home 14 years ago, she was 6 months old. She was another rescue living in a shelter, the Humane Society. And we brought her home. And at the time, this is way before 9/11, and way before my knowledge of what Islam actually was. And I didn't even have the internet. But we had neighbors across the street, and we were rather friendly with them. The wife is a Christian. The husband is a Muslim, I found out later. And very, very, very nice people, Michael. Very nice people. And when we brought a puppy Brandy home, Wendy came over to take a look at him and pet him and stuff, and Ashif came over and stood back but grinned. He looked, good for you guys. You rescued a dog and stuff. But this person never petted my dog, never came near it. And I, at the time, I chalked it up to him being simply afraid of dogs. But now I understand exactly.
Well, no, it's part of the of this backward, barbaric, intolerant ideology. And in many countries, for example, in Spain, in a particular section of Spain, many dogs in that area, going back a few years, were found poisoned to death. I think there was an attempt in a Western European nation, I don't recall the name of the country, where in a particular section where it was predominantly Islamic, they wanted to actually ban dogs. This is what these savages do. You know, they come into a country.
Oh, I know.
It's not your country, you know, and you come in there, you're an invader, and now you want to force, you know, your backward, demented ideology on people who've been living in a free, open society, and, you know, part of their culture, especially here in America, you know, having a dog is just part of our culture. By the way, a lot of my friends who did go to Afghanistan in the Marine Corps and the Army told me they found it very hard being there because, you know, the Muslims in Afghanistan would torture and kill dogs, and they have dog fights on Friday nights. And you take any civilized person and you put them in that environment, and, you know, they have to observe this barbaric culture. It infuriates them, of course, and it just disgusts them. It's a disgusting thing to do, to harm an animal, you know, in the manner that they do. They do it in Pakistan. It's commonplace in other Islamic countries. You know, there's one video, I think, on YouTube where they poured some lighter fluid on a small dog and set it on fire. They thought it was amusing. I won't go into on the air what I think.
They do this to what are referred to as Christian donkeys as well.
Mm-hmm.
And these are donkeys that have very unique striping on their backs. It looks like a cross, so they're referred to as Christian donkeys, and they like to throw them over cliffs. They're barbaric.
Well, if you look at the behavior of people of other faiths, you know, you just don't see this kind of behavior. You don't see these kind of teachings. It just doesn't exist. Buddhists don't go around doing that. Hindus pretty much don't. They may not. I don't know what they think of dogs, but I know they don't do that. Christians don't. Jewish people don't. Am I leaving anybody out? Atheists? If there are any atheists listening, I don't think you people go around doing that.
Yeah.
But Muslims do. So it's a problem.
And
whenever you're ready, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I do have something I want to share to close out this segment because I think it's really appropriate, and I believe everybody who hears this will appreciate it. So, you know, whenever you say it's time to move on, I would like to read something briefly.
Please do. Please do.
Okay. Many years ago, a close friend of mine who is a World War II veteran and a great lover of dogs, he owned many dogs. He gave me a copy of this. I actually have the original copy, here it is. It's called A Tribute to a Dog. It reads, "The one absolutely unselfish friend that man can have in this selfish world, the one that never deserts him, the one that never proves ungrateful or treacherous, is his dog. A man's dog stands by him in prosperity and in poverty, in health and in sickness. He will sleep on the cold ground where the wintry winds blow and the snow drives fiercely, if only he may be near his master's side. He will kiss the hand that has no food to offer. He will lick the wounds and sores that come in counter with the roughness of this world. He guards the sleep of his pauper master as if he were a prince. And would all other friends desert, he shall remain. When riches take wing and reputation falls to pieces, the dog he is as constant in his love as the sun in its journey through the heavens." That was written in 1870 by a man named Senator George Vest in the United States.
That is beautiful. That is that's moving because hey, Michael, can you send that to me later on? I would really, really, really like to have that. That is exactly my sentiment, and I want to thank you for that very, very much. We've been covering a lot of ground tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and Michael, my friend, has been helping me get through so much material. I am so eternally grateful to you, Michael, for being here and helping me through these topics. I uploaded something here. We're going to play the Israeli National Anthem. We're going to devote the last segment of the program to Israel. But, Michael, I want you to set up this song.
It's a great recording. And it's called Hativa. It means hope. And let's all please be aware that out of the ashes of the Holocaust, the nation of Israel was reborn. It was a nation thousands of years ago. I believe God established it. In AD 70, the Romans sacked the city of Jerusalem, and the Jews were dispersed. It was called the Diaspora, and they spread throughout the world, a lot of them in Europe. And, of course, we know during World War II, the Jews were a primary target of the Nazis. It's called the Final Solution, to exterminate all Jews within the area they controlled, which was much of Europe at the time. And the Jews of World War II that did survive, the refugees, really had nowhere to go. And there is a prophecy in the Bible for those that believe that God would bring the nation of Israel back into existence, and he did. And since that time, in 1948, the neighbors of Israel, the Arab Muslim neighbors, have continuously been attacking this small country, attempting to destroy it and so forth. And it is the only true democracy in that part of the world. I believe it's important to be in solidarity with the nation of Israel, because for decades they've been fighting the Islamist fascists, you know, on the battlefield. They make a great sacrifice. Currently they're at war again in Gaza. And, you know, to show respect and acknowledgement to the nation of Israel is the reason I wanted the audience to hear this song.
Sending that to me so that I could put it in the studio and share with the listeners. That is beautiful. And how you set it up is, well, once again, I swear, sometimes when I do these shows, I have to have a box of Kleenex beside me, because I do get so moved by the things that we cover. But Israel is a land of hope, and a land of joy, sunlight, beauty, and ambition for their progeny. And unlike what's happening in Islam, which is nothing but black soul darkness, hellfire, and what's going on in Israel right now between Hamas and the Israeli peoples is devastating. I'm going to ask you, Michael, what we're witnessing right now. This has been going on, I think we're on day 15 that the rockets have been being fired into Israel. Israel is trying so very hard to not harm civilians, women and children, but Hamas is putting them in front as human targets, and we're getting so many messages that, oh, look at the death toll. Oh, you know, the fails, the Palestinians, I call them the fails. Oh, they're losing a lot more lives than Israel. But it's because Israel uses its weapons to protect their people, whereas Hamas uses weapons to... Well, they use their people, rather, to protect their weapons. The Hamas, they're shooting rockets from mosques, children's playgrounds, schoolyards, homes. Israel, they let the Palestinians know, look, this is the target we're going to. They drop leaflets. And they make phone calls and say, get the women and the children, get the civilians out of there. Hamas does nothing. Michael, what do you think the resolution of this should be? Do you think that Israel should annihilate Hamas once and for all?
Absolutely. Let's look at who Hamas is. They are a terrorist organization. They have a charter. It's called the Charter of 1988. Let me share an excerpt of that charter with the audience. This manifesto, as we'll identify it, it has about 36 separate articles. It promotes the primary goals of Hamas, and it focuses on the total destruction of the nation of Israel through jihad, as they say, Islamic holy war. In the preamble of the charter, it says very clearly, Israel will exist and will continue to exist until Islam, emphasis on Islam, will obliterate it, just as it has obliterated others before. So it's really not about land. I mean, in one respect, yes, it is, because they do not believe that the Jews have any right to the land, even though they were there historically.
Yeah.
The historical record and the Bible, of course, which is also a historical record besides a spiritual book, it confirms, and we know archaeologically, that the Jews were there thousands of years ago. Okay,
yeah.
Muslims have this nonsense that Muhammad in a dream went to Jerusalem. Muhammad never physically went to the land of Israel. Muhammad was in Mecca and Medina, which is, you know, the holiest area to Sunni Muslims. But Muslims,
oh, yeah,
in their fascist thinking, you know, they believe that that is the land of Islam, and, you know, Jews have no right to it. More important, in the Hamas charter, in Article 7, is a great incitement to hatred of Jews, and it comes from a hadith. And it reads, the day of judgment will not come about until Muslims fight Jews and kill them. Then the Jews shall hide behind rocks and trees, and the rocks and trees will cry out, excuse me, the rocks and trees shall cry out, O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me. Come and kill him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is absolutely absurd to think that you can have any kind of peace treaty with people who adhere to and espouse this evil, this hate. It's hatred of Jews. It's not just Israelis or Zionists. You know, Muslims will say, well, you know, we hate Zionists, which are those that believe the nation of Israel should exist, whether they are a Christian
mm-hmm.
Zionist or a atheist Zionist or, of course, a Jewish Zionist. But no, it's basically hatred of Jews. And, of course, thousands of rockets have been fired from Gaza into Israel. Let's get a little history. 2006, the nation of Israel agrees to give back what was called Gush Katif, which had about 10,000 Israeli settlers. The Israeli government and then even the Israeli army physically evicted these people, and they completely left Gaza unto the Palestinians. The Palestinians decided to elect a group called Hamas as their government and their leaders. That, remember, 1988 charter, and that's just a few things, you know, I shared. So 80% of the Palestinians elect Hamas, and anyone who knows about this, you can go on YouTube or just go on the Internet and you can research the hatred that they teach their children about Jews. It's just extreme. It's extreme. When you take a little child and fill its heart and mind with this kind of poison, and you teach it that when this child grows up to kill Jews and, you know, to become a martyr, martyrdom, and so forth, and you have a large percentage of the population, I would say the majority of the people in Gaza have this belief. So I believe at this point that they are no longer entitled to be there, because if they had any right to be there, first of all, and that's debatable, but let's say they did, they forfeited it by their intense acts of violence and their completely committed desire and intention to wipe out the Jewish people in the land of Israel.
What is going on, though, what we're seeing in the mainstream media is rather disturbing. People are being sold a false bill of goods in that when they talk about, those nasty Israelis, they're at it again, and, what are we going to do about this? And, it's always the nasty Israelis and the Iron Dome, you know, they have the advantage, they have the technology, and therefore they're killing more people. But people don't understand exactly how the scenarios are playing out. And Obama coming on the air and saying that he has great concerns about the Palestinian death toll. He's a Muslim. We know that. I mean, that's been determined. Maybe he practices Christianity, but by birthright he is a Muslim because his father was a Muslim. And we know where his sentiments lie. We know that he is determined to see the annihilation of Israel. If he doesn't say it out loud, we know that that is in his heart. We have about 5 minutes left to discuss, and Michael, what I want to do is I want to give you talking points on that perspective. What do you think the American government is doing to protect Israel? Unlike Canada, who are staunch supporters, and we're on record of saying Israel has a right to exist, and hell be damned with the Palestinians. There's a lot of people that think, of course, the Palestinians should be sent out, get rid of them, and send them back to an Arabic country, or at the very least, send them back to Jordan. What do you think about that? And I'm going to give you a whole lot of talking points there.
There's not going to be any chance for peace. First of all, Fatah, which is the Palestinian Authority, which existed before Hamas under Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat was a terrorist. Fatah has a brigade called the Al-Aqsa Brigades, and they are terrorists.
Yeah.
Fatah has decided to form a coalition government, including Hamas. Hamas is a terrorist organization. Therefore, how can you ask a nation to negotiate a peace treaty? You know, how can you ask Israel to accept any kind of treaty or truce or any kind of agreement or so-called two-state solution when 50% of the government and 50% of the people in the land, which is Gaza and the West Bank, are committed to acts of terrorism? You know, no other nation would even entertain that. But as we know, for decades, the Western media, which is run mainly by leftists and liberals, have always vilified Israel and demonized them. And, you know, the Palestinians are oppressed people, and, you know, Israel's doing all these terrible things to them. But, you know, after basic research, like you said, the facts are is that these Hamas terrorists use their own people, women and children, as human shields. They deliberately store their weapons and fire their weapons from civilian areas such as hospitals and playgrounds and schools. And, you know, what is Israel supposed to do? They have no choice. They have to take out, you know, they have to take out those weapons. They have to degrade their ability to fire rockets into Israel. The reason, of course, there's a disproportionate number of civilians killed on the Israeli side is because the weapons Hamas has, thank God, are not that effective. They don't have the kind of weaponry that Israel has. So that does that mean that Israel is, you know, Israel, you know, are the bad guys? That's this idiotic reasoning that these liberal idiots use.
No, they're just more effective.
Yeah, of course.
Hey, we have somebody here. We have somebody here that has a question or a comment, and that is my dear friend, and that is Sue from New Mexico. And Sue, hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine. It's just a great show, and the one thing that we have to do in America, we have to keep up the campaign to defund Hamas. Once and for all, no more money. And so anybody out there, when you tweet, we're trying to get Defund Hamas hashtag to continuously trend. And let me tell you, you will get attacked on Twitter, but it's worth it. Anyway, great show. Michael, I always love listening to you.
Michael will be back on the airwaves much more often in the future, Sue. And, Sue,
that's
I agree
great.
With everything that you say. And God bless you, honey. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, Sue from New Mexico usually joins me on Fridays as a silent partner in the studio because I get nervous nellies and butterflies in my belly. And it's kind of like when I log into the studio and I see Sue there, we have a little pep chat. And Sue always assures me, you know what you're doing and you'll be fine. And having Sue sit beside me, because as you know, I'm left to my own devices on Friday. But knowing that Sue is there is just my comfort blanket. It's my reassurance. Sue, thanks.
Oh, you know I love you, Kel, and thank you. God
love
bless
you too,
both
sis.
Of you.
Thanks, Sue. Okay, honey, I'll talk to you later. And
okay.
We are wrapping it up now, and we are down to our last 4 minutes. Michael, I cannot thank you enough for being part of the program tonight. You have been instrumental in helping me out with some of these very important issues that we got through this evening. I really hope that people garnered a lot of knowledge that Michael Green, Pastor Michael Green, imparted upon you. And believe me, Michael Green, he is going to be a voice on either Red Fox Blogger, Radio Jihad Network, and anywhere else he's invited to speak, because this man has a voice. He uses it knowledgeably and intelligently, and he comes armed with knowledge that he is going to share with all of us. So, Michael Green, I want to thank you so very much.
Thanks, Kel, for inviting me on your program. I want to add, before you close out, I would ask people to please pray for the nation of Israel and pray for their soldiers who are in harm's way at this very moment. You know, it's a devastating thing to lose a family member on the battlefield in war, you know, to learn. You know, the way you learn is you don't get any advance notice, but you get notified by other people in the military that your loved one is gone. and it's very traumatic. You know, let's say this also. No one is joyful. None of us want to see Palestinian civilians be killed or harmed, especially children. The nation of Israel does more than any other country, really, you know, to avoid civilian casualties. And when you have an enemy that will use civilians as shields, it puts you in a very difficult position. So the blood of those Palestinians who have lost their lives in Gaza is on the head of Hamas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, that song that Michael sent to me, that one is staying in the studio, and that's going to, the national anthem of Israel is going to be played quite often on this radio program until there is a resolution. Israel has a right to exist, and if we abandon Israel now, we are doomed, because that is the last democracy in the Middle East. As Israel goes, so will the rest of us if we are so easy to cave in. We have to be resolute. We have to stand up. We have to stand up in our respective countries. Ladies and gentlemen, it is mass Islamity. We have to stop the insanity and recognize that Islam is a political entity. Hey, Michael. I'll be talking with you soon.
Thanks again, Kel.
You bet. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining the Red Fox Blogger. I'll see you back here with Tim Burton Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Have a great weekend, everyone. God bless you all.